Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion, featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at The Bulwark, and I am joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and The Wall Street Journal, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. We are delighted this week to welcome as our special guest, Peter Wehner, contributor to The New York Times and The Atlantic. Welcome, one and all. We have a lot to get to this week, and I'd like to begin with Holy Week and with the celebration that Donald Trump is participating in regarding this religious observance. He is hawking the, quote, only Bible endorsed by President Trump. He calls it easy to read. It has large print. And he says, Happy Holy Week. Let's make America pray again. And he wants to encourage everyone to get one. Also, this is the Lee Greenwood version of the Bible. So it not only contains the King James version of the Bible, but it also includes copies of the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the Pledge of Allegiance, as well as a handwritten chorus from the Lee Greenwood song, Proud to Be an American. So, Pete, I cannot phrase it better than what Nick Cattagio of The Dispatch wrote. He said, this sales pitch distills the man to his essence in a way that few Trump soundbites do. Simultaneously sinister, amusing, grossly hypocritical, wincingly kitschy, and dripping with raw hucksterism. But you write a lot about evangelicalism, and this does have a lot of resonance among evangelicals. So I'd like you to talk about that and about the Christian nationalism angle here.
Sure. Two things, just in terms of what Trump was doing with selling the Lee Greenwood Bible. He's a person of kaleidoscopic depravity. There's nihilism, there's cruelty, there's lawlessness, there's mendacity. I think this is sort of the low-rent Trump, the crude Trump, the person who will peddle anything for money. It's worth keeping in mind the context in which this took place, which is he's going to raise money off of this, in part because he's paying an astronomically high sum for having found liable of sexual assault, what the judge in the case referred to as rape. And next month, he's going on trial for having paid hush money to a porn star. So this is the character of the man who is hawking the Bible. But as you allude to, Mona, this isn't new for Trump. What it almost always gets back to as it relates to the importance of the country is what it says about his supporters. And his grip on them has been a absolutely stunning, in some respects, and sociologically, theologically fascinating thing to see. I'd make one point about it, which is if you engage, as I do, with Trump supporters who are Christians, they will often frame this as a binary choice between Trump and Biden or a liberal, and say that on issues that they care about, abortion or otherwise, that tips the needle to Trump. What we've just witnessed in the Republican primary is not that. You had Trump versus a number of conservatives, including preeminently Nikki Haley, former successful governor, pro-life, committed a conservative longer than he has been, beats Biden in the polls, and yet by overwhelming numbers, they went not with her, but with him, which means that he's their first choice, not their last, which means there's something about Donald Trump as a person that resonates with them, even as they claim to be Christians. And that is a crisis for American Christianity.
So I should explain to people who don't know you, Pete, that you are a Christian and have been part of this world your whole adult life, as I understand it, though you are now in a very small minority of people who are outspokenly anti-Trump within that world. So our mutual friend Russell Moore had a piece this week, and I'd love to hear you on this also, because it speaks to the way in which, you know, at the beginning, when Trump first emerged, the idea was, well, there was a bargain, that evangelicals made. They were willing to accept Trump's hypocrisy and the fact that they understood he was not a sincere Christian or any of that. They were willing to make a deal that, you know, in return for their support, they would get the policy goals that were important to them. And what Russell Moore has written this week, he said, I guess Ned Flanders now goes to strip shows, which is, you know, the idea that, no, actually what has happened is that the evangelical world, or at least chunks of it, have come more to resemble Trump's morality than the other way around.
Yeah, that's right. I thought Russell's piece was very, very powerful. And it is true. There has been a psychology of accommodation that's happened within the evangelical world. So what things that they opposed 8 years ago are things that they embraced now. There's no question some of that's gone on. I'd only add one point, which I don't think gets quite enough play in trying to understand this phenomenon, which is, and Kristen Demay, who you've had on, has talked about this before. In many ways, Trump was represented the fulfillment, not the betrayal of certain evangelical values. They actually didn't get much play because there was a lot of talk of personal morality with Clinton and so forth. But Trump was to them a kind of spiritual badass, as it's been said, a perfect fighting machine. And so if you are familiar with the evangelical subculture of the last 50 years, he was tapping into something. Again, remember, the point I made about the primary this year applied to 2016 too. And they overwhelmingly went with him then, as opposed to a whole variety of other Republicans. There was something about Trump, what he personified, what he embodied. He's a kind of beau ideal to a lot of them. And it's hard to make sense of it, certainly from my perspective, antithetical to any understanding of the Bible and the New Testament that I have. But it's out there, and it's doing an enormous amount of damage to the country and to the Christian witness.
Linda, one of the things that you often heard back when I was more in this world than I am now and had more conservative and Christian contacts, the way it was framed was always, we're on defense. You know, it is the liberals who are imposing their values on us, who are not letting us live or worship or be in a way that we're comfortable with. And so we weren't interested in politics. We just were tending our own gardens. And they came in with their intrusive governments and their intrusive culture. And so this is just defensive on our part. What do you make of that argument?
There's a certain amount of truth in the fact that the secular world, particularly Hollywood, many elites, have looked down their nose at people who are religious and devoutly religious. But one can make that criticism and think it's a valid criticism and still be horrified by, as someone, I don't know if it was Peter or someone else who talked about Trump as sort of a, you know, running a picture of the seven deadly sins. I mean, he literally exemplifies every single one of them. I once wrote a column to that effect, and my editor wouldn't let me include gluttony because they said I was calling him fat. Well,
The one thing you're not allowed to do is fat shaming.
Right, yeah. But look, it is serious. You know, we've had hucksters in the clothes of clergymen, you know, for as long as I've been alive and even before I've been alive. You've had it among evangelical Christians. You've had it among Catholics, where you've had, you know, people on air sort of selling things, selling an ideology. And that's regrettable. But the idea that you can be a faithful, believing person and want to exemplify Christ-like behavior, which is what an obligation of Christians is to try the best they can to emulate Christ in their daily lives. And then have this man as a paragon and someone you look to. It is horrifying. And I will just say about the Bible, I'm glad he chose the King James Version, one of my favorite versions, it and the Douay Rheims, which is one of the oldest Catholic versions and has a similar kind of poetry to the King James. But the idea that, you know, he put this into a volume, he put the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and other things in it. You know, I've always believed that our founders didn't so much want to drive religion from the public square as they did see that government should not be imposing any particular religious belief on Americans. But I don't like this kind of conjoining the two. And one of the things that a friend of mine who's much more active on Twitter, X, than I am, has noted is that trending on the right, on the political right, is the phrase, Christ is King. And it is, you know, this is Holy Week. Sunday will be Easter. It's the holiest day in the Christian calendar. One would like to think that maybe these people were just talking about that in terms of the week. But my fear is, and certainly if you read the post, the suggestion is quite different. And that is that they want to impose a kind of Christian nationalism on America. And that, I think, is incredibly dangerous.
Damon, this gets back to a topic that we discussed with Tim Alberta when he was on about the really the kind of sacrilegious or blasphemous worship of America that has become so prevalent in evangelical churches, and frankly, even practically worship of Trump himself. It's getting awfully close to that. But one sort of maybe straw in the wind from a few years ago, I don't know if you remember this, but it might have been around 2017 or 2018 perhaps, but Glenn Beck, who initially had backed away from Trumpism, decided to make a stand and to at least try to be Christian as he saw it by bringing supplies to migrants at the border and showing compassion for people who were in desperate situations. And he specifically framed it as a Christian thing to do. And he got so much blowback. It was almost as if the Christians were saying to him, who told you all this rot about, you know, love thy neighbor? Where'd you get that liberal claptrap, you know? But anyway, you know, it is amazing, isn't it, that there is so little sense of sacrilege here that so-called believing Christians don't recoil and say, this is cheesy. I mean, the Lee Greenwood business, you know, it's exploitative, it's cheesy, it's hucksterism. But instead, he's probably going to make a big fortune selling Bibles for $60 a pop.
Yeah, we talked about elements of this, as you said, in the Tim Alberta episode of the pod, but also when David French was here a few weeks ago, we touched on it again, and it keeps coming up, and I think it's a really important point that doesn't get enough emphasis in our general discussions of politics, that one way to put it is to say, yes, Christian nationalism is a problem and a threat, but it goes both directions. The way I think liberals often talk about it as if Christianity is this kind of static, threatening thing out there, and it's dangerous because it's trying to impose itself on the nation. That's Christian nationalism. But I think what we're talking about here is actually in some ways the reverse, or at least a synthesis of the other side with that, which is a convergence between the understanding of Christianity and nationalism, so that it's not Christians imposing their theological convictions on the nation. It is an eliding of a distinction between Christianity and national feeling, such that what you end up with is a redefinition of what it means to be a Christian in terms of what a right-wing version of American nationalism, namely as defined by Trump and his seething cauldron of passions and impulses, think it is. And that has been made possible by a lot of trends. Some of them go back, as Pete said, into the history of the distinctive forms of Protestantism in the United States. But a lot of it has to do with secularization itself, that it is not that Trump represents pushing back against secularism. He represents the form of a certain kind of Christian piety will take in a secular context, such that a lot of these people who claim to be Christians, who will buy the $59.95 Lee Greenwood Bible with the imprimatur of Donald Trump on it, are not people who really are reading the Bible. They are not people who are regularly going to church and involved in a church community and engaged in faith-based charity. These are people who now define being a Christian as voting for Donald Trump because he has certain enemies and they have certain enemies and he punches those enemies better than anyone ever did. And so he is now the guy. To be a Christian is to vote for Trump. And that way, it's not so much Christianity being imposed on the nation as Christianity being redefined so that being a nationalist as defined by Donald Trump is what it means to be Christian. And that is a kind of danger. I mean, the last thing I'll say, I know I've quoted this before, this line, you know, Pete knows my history better than most people. My own criticism of the religious right under George W. Bush, and I broke from the right at that time. I wrote a book about it. Ross Douthat had this tweet back in the winter of 2016 when Trump was first winning primaries, and he just said, aimed at people like me who had made those arguments. Boy, if you didn't like the religious right, you sure are going to hate the post-religious right. And we sort of have now a kind of religious right that is at the same time post-religious, post-Christian, and has redefined Christianity as that, which is hard to wrap your mind around, but I don't think there's any other way to make sense of it.
Bill Galston, these couple of quotations leap to mind. One was attributed to Chesterton, although it may be apocryphal, as all great quotes seem to be, but it was when people cease believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, they'll believe in anything. But the other is a quote from Donald Trump, who, when he was asked what his, you know, speaking of Damon saying these are not people who actually are going to read the Bible, Trump was asked what his favorite Bible verse was, and he said, an eye for an eye, which is, yeah.
Oh, so that's good.
Completely in character, you got to say. But so there is, again, this theme of sort of rejecting all of the loving and softer messages of Christianity that have sort of, you know, been arguably, you know, source of success for a couple thousand years. But here's Charlie Kirk, that great evangelist, who is now saying that theological seminaries are destructive influences because they are creating, quote, weak beta males, overly feminine pastor men who bring this unclean spirit that needs to be excommunicated. So that, again, is, you know, Kristen Dumez's theory there, that it's, again, this kind of worship of masculinity instead of God. You think this is part of it? And as you look at the polling on where people are religiously speaking, which I know you know you do a poll about these things, what's your sense of where all this is in terms of the population at large?
Well, I'm tempted to say in the lawyer's manner, you know, res ipsa locatur. The thing speaks for itself, but I guess I'm duty-bound as a member of this podcast to go a little bit beyond that. So I will say that a group that I'm a member of has done extensive polling on the convergence of Christianity and American nationalism that we've been talking about. And we have discovered that a substantial number of Americans believe that you're not a real American if you're not a Christian. So from that standpoint, it's not a convergence. You know, it is what is considered to be an historical fact, which at one point, for all practical purposes, was an historical fact. And one of the things we're talking about is what happens to this definitional sense of the complete overlap of these two things when it ceases to be true sociologically and demographically. What happens when people who used to define the country no longer do so? You know, they feel decentered, displaced in a certain way. And, you know, and the again in the famous slogan speaks to people, whether they are working class people or evangelicals or both, who used to feel that they were the center of the American action, the salt of the American earth, and now they're not the dominant tone in the court. And I think they feel this loss very keenly. But I want to go a little bit beyond this presentism, because, you know, the question of how we got here really interests me. And I don't think it's a short process. So with your permission, I'd like to pose a question or two to Pete, because he really knows what I only suspect. I've been alive long enough to see, you know, the moment at which there seemed to be a possible convergence or at least reconciliation between a Democratic Party that had already adjusted to, you know, the culture wars on the one hand and, you know, and politics on the other. That came during the Carter administration. And my impression is that some things happened during the Carter administration that moved that discussion onto a different course. And obviously, Supreme Court decisions on school prayer are part of this. But another big part of this has to do with the clash between racial progress on the one hand and the standing of Christian institutions on the other, right? If you're a Christian institution that practices racial segregation, then your definition of being left alone is not having, you know, norms of racial equality apply to you. And you may think that you deserve to practice, you know, racial separation as you define it and get a tax exemption. And during the period that I'm talking about, those practices came under attack. So my hunch, and this is why I'm appealing to Pete, is that the sense of government intrusion on Christian practice has a lot to do with the battles, not only over school prayer, but over racial segregation. Is there anything to what I've just said?
Yeah, I think there is. A couple things, Bill. The first is, this is actually not well understood. The pro-life movement was not a particularly strong movement in the early 70s when Roe v. Wade happened. That happened later. The Southern Baptist Convention was actually fine with legalization of abortions. What happened with the Southern Baptist Convention was there was a conservative takeover in the early 80s. I think it's fair to say that race has been a larger factor both in the Republican Party and within the Christian movement and the evangelical movement than a lot of people would like to admit. The degree to which it is hard to tell, but the effort to try and stop tax exemption for Bob Jones University in the 70s was a key moment for a lot of Christians. And then there's just the reality that we're sort of seeing, I would say, the Southern evangelicalism taking over much of broader evangelicalism. And that is still the issue of race, obviously was a factor, you know, 50, 60 years ago, but I think it still exists. I don't think that's all of it. I don't think it's primarily that. But you're quite right. If you go back and look at the polling data from Jimmy Carter versus Gerald Ford, they basically split the evangelical vote. It was the Reagan election that really was an inflection point for that movement. But there was something that preceded the Reagan's election, and that was the rise of the Moral Majority and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. What had happened was a lot of evangelicals who had been on the sideline of American politics, some of it grounded in what they believed were theological reasons, reversed themselves. Jerry Falwell was a perfect example. He was essentially Anabaptist, Plymouth Brethren. The world is too stained. Our job is to save souls, not to reform laws. That's where he was during the civil rights era, even as he was criticizing Martin Luther King Jr. And then he flipped. Once they got involved in politics, that began, now we're talking 50 years ago, that began an affiliation that I think net has been harmful to both politics and to faith.
All right. We will leave it there and move on to another topic, which is the response on the right to Donald Trump's legal woes. We are about to see, starting in a couple of weeks, Trump face his first criminal trial. And that is the, well, some people want to call it an election interference case. Other people want to call it a hush money for a porn star case. But one thing that you hear a lot is that on the part of the either anti-Trump forces or the or just the outright pro-Trump forces is that this is lawfare, that this is the attempt by Biden and the powers that be, the establishment liberals and Democrats, to take down Trump by hook or by crook using any legal means available to them, and that therefore it is both illegitimate and also a terrible precedent, because now it will open the door to criminalizing every successive administration, will then, you know, find reasons to indict their predecessors. So, Damon, I'm going to come to you first. You were, of course, as everybody knows, very dubious about the strategy of indicting Trump at all. But what do you make of this argument about lawfare?
Yeah, it's interesting how these things work in the kind of political ecosystem of like punditry and stuff, because I hadn't heard anyone make this exact argument until a friend of mine who has a lot of ties to kind of Trump world, is an old friend of mine. He DM'd me on Twitter X about, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks ago when the 9-digit fraud penalty was announced. And he was just very beside himself about this, and he used the term lawfare in this way. And I hadn't heard the argument before, and now, you know, it's been made, Rich Lowry is making the argument in National Review, and others are doing it online all the time. And his argument was very simple. He just said, do prosecutors regularly look at the books of very wealthy businessmen, real estate developers, in order to search for this kind of fraud where you basically inflate the value of your properties for the purpose of getting loans and then you understate the value for the sake of avoiding taxes? If this is not a regular thing that is done and they're going after Trump for it, that is itself an attack on the rule of law, because it shows that they have double standards and they're being unduly harsh to this one guy, and it's for political reasons. And my answer to him is actually not that complicated. It's, have you ever talked to anyone who understands politics about how they talk to candidates who propose running for president? If you do, they will say the first thing out of their mouth is going to be, have you done anything that will get you in trouble? Because they are going to find it and it will destroy your candidacy and probably your marriage and your business and everything. If you either, your choice is, if there is something like this, you either come clean about it up front and hope you can write it out, or you don't run, because they are going to find it out. So my answer to my friend about Trump is, Trump could have remained a crook. He just had to not run for president. He ran for president, and that put all the Klieg lights of the media, journalists, and prosecutors on this guy. And it's now been 9 years since this whole started in the summer of 2015, and he's running again. And it took a long time to get this far. It's good that the legal wheels, you know, move slowly. It takes a long time to investigate and make judgments about what to charge the guy with. And then, as we've seen in all these trials, you know, the defendant gets to raise objections and make motions to delay it or to dismiss charges and so forth. So it takes a long time. But the fact is, this is happening not because the law enforcement arms of our government at state and federal levels are singling Trump out. It's happening because he singled himself out by running for the nation's highest office in the land. That's going to happen when you do that. So it doesn't mean in any particular case, maybe a prosecutor goes too far, and we should always be open to such objections. That's why you're allowed to appeal. But the fact that he's being scrutinized in this way and they are finding bad behavior, misdeeds and crimes is because he has committed them, or at least has been alleged, and it has to be examined in a court of law. It's his own fault. Again, it's probably true. He just would have been a billionaire who gets written up on page six in the New York Post and gets some attention from doing his reality show stuff on television. If he had chosen to do that, they probably never would have looked into it. And that's not a great thing that you can get away with that kind of stuff if you're just an average rich person. But it's certainly, you don't solve that by saying, yeah, but we shouldn't go after the guy running for president either. That's not a very good argument.
I would just add, he's not just accused. He's an adjudicated crook.
There are so many charges and so many trials.
Yes, But in the civil fraud case, and most recently, he was adjudicated to have defrauded the state of New York and a lot of other people. So, Bill, picking up on Damon's point, I would just say, here's the counter argument. People would say, well, sure, if you run for president, you expect scrutiny, but usually it's the press that will uncover damaging facts of your life and destroy your reputation, perhaps, but it won't be a prosecutor that is coming after you. And Letitia James specifically promised to go after Trump, which is not something that attorneys general or prosecutors are supposed to do. So how would you react to that?
Well, I react to that by saying that there's probably some truth to that. Letitia James is, you know, a partisan who doesn't hide her partisanship. I think it's fair to say. But here's what's for me the deeper point. As is almost always the case, Donald Trump leaves us with no good choices. On the one hand, he's a crook. On the other hand, going after him for the crimes that he's committed will have the knock-on effects that a lot of people are warning about. It will, in fact, you know, whether rightly or wrongly, contribute, I think, to the temptation, not to be resisted, to retaliate in kind. And so whether or not you tolerate his not only excesses, but also breaches of law, or don't, you end up contributing to the degradation of the American political system. And so I can take on board every jot and tittle of Damon's argument and still accept the consequentialist argument that this process of this legal process directed at Trump will invite a damaging equal and opposite reaction, or maybe more than equal. Is that a compelling reason not to do it? No. But to repeat, the essence of Donald Trump is that he leaves everybody around him with no good choices. And here we are.
Yeah, so that's, let me just take a red marker and underline what Bill just said, because the logic of Rich Lowry's piece and others who've made this case, where he says, okay, you know, you've asked for it now. If Trump is reelected, he should indict Biden because that's the new standard, and he should tell Robert Hur to go ahead and bring charges against Biden for mishandling classified information. So, okay, what then do you do about the fact, if that's the standard you're going to employ, does that mean that what Trump did in the classified documents case, where he willfully withheld the most secret kinds of documents involving national defense information, nuclear powers, et cetera, obviously obstructed justice, attempted to destroy security tapes that would show him hiding the boxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Again, as Bill says, he puts you in an impossible position, because then by Lowry's logic, I guess you really can't bring charges against Trump for this flagrant criminal behavior because it might encourage irresponsible people to do something to retaliate.
Yeah, I think it borders on absurd to think that Donald Trump would need a pretext to indict Joe Biden or do anything. That is, you know, just assume that this never happened, that he was never indicted on legitimate grounds. Does anyone think a man with his sociopathic tendencies wouldn't act in any event? Of course he would have. So I just think the premise itself is flawed. The second thing I would ask Rich is, where were you when you, in the late 1990s, when you wanted Bill Clinton convicted and impeached on perjury charges? I think there was a legitimate case to be made, but I'll also say this, if you compare Bill Clinton to Donald Trump, Bill Clinton is a Boy Scout.
Absolutely.
So, you know, the people that, I suppose, if you want to use that argument that catapulted lawfare into our American politics in a big way were Republicans in the 90s with Clinton. So they should probably reflect on that before they make the arguments that Rich is against people who are going after a man of extraordinary depravity.
Yeah, Linda.
Well, you know, if we were all those of us who think that Trump is not fit to be president, were all powerful and had, you know, great strategic minds, and we were all sort of plotting how to get him, the first thing we would have done was to sit down and say, okay, there are some cases that should go first, and probably the financial shenanigans case and the Stormy Daniels case should not be the first two cases that the public is presented with. We ought to go with the January 6th case and the documents case. So this idea that somehow this is some grand conspiracy that we're all involved in of engaging in lawfare, it is nonsense. But I think there's a bigger issue. And that is essentially what Pete was suggesting, but also others. And that is, how do you let him get away with some of the things that he has done? You know, on the documents case, Reality Winner, I think she's still in jail for having taken a couple of documents and posted them on a gaming site. She shouldn't have done that. It was wrong. She probably should still be in jail. It was a serious crime. But how do you compare that to what Donald Trump did? And how do you say that he should not, in fact, suffer the consequences, not just in terms of his insisting on taking these documents, which he had no right to whatsoever, but even more importantly, obstructing justice when the archives came after them, when the government, Department of Justice came after them, and when the FBI showed up with a legitimate search warrant and searched his property. So I think that going down the path of looking the other way for everything that Donald Trump does, because it might be politically disadvantageous, is really dangerous. And Pete is exactly right. Donald Trump has already announced and been announcing for some time, and he did it the last time around as well, that he's going to go after people with the law when he gets to be president again. If he gets, I hope, not when, but, you know, he is engaged in using the judicial system to punish people. That is not what's going on here, particularly not in the two Jack Smith cases. These are serious crimes that he is accused of. He must be held accountable. And in our system, that means presenting evidence to a jury of one's peers and letting that jury decide guilty or not guilty. And it's really unfortunate that that does not appear like it's going to happen before the election.
Yeah, we can just throw in, maybe we'll talk about this in a coming episode, but it sure does look like Eileen Cannon has managed to screw things up badly enough through both incompetence and probably bias in Trump's favor that case, the far and away strongest case against Trump, will not come to trial before the election. And that is just a terrible, terrible miscarriage of justice right there. But let me just take this opportunity as somebody who does have a law degree to just make a couple of just legal points that I think are useful here. So one of the arguments that I think needs to be rebutted is this notion that the Letitia James civil fraud case is illegitimate because there were no victims here. And that, you know, the bank's loans were repaid. And so the fact that she is bringing a fraud case of this magnitude is just completely out of bounds. Well, the fact is that a state attorneys general have the power to bring lots of different kinds of cases where you could say there are no victims, or where the victims are too diffuse to bring the cases themselves, or when it would be too onerous for victims. And we see this all the time. You see it in, for example, when a whole consortium of attorneys general sued the tobacco companies. That was, you know, again, you could say it was victimless in the sense that every person who purchased a pack of cigarettes got what they paid for, but there was a larger harm. It happens in antitrust cases. And, you know, if you want a more recent example, it happened in the Trump University case, another case for which he was found liable. Again, there were many, many victims, and they didn't individually bring cases against him, or some might have attempted to. But in any event, it is in the interests of justice for a state attorney general to lay down the law and say, fraud is something that harms the larger workings of our economy and our society, and therefore the state has an interest in cracking down on fraud and is empowered to do so. So I think it's worth keeping that in mind too. All right, let us turn now to Mr. Putin, Trump's mentor, who, you know, there was a terrible terrorist attack in Moscow. It turns out that the U.S. warned Putin about this, the possibility of this upcoming attack. Putin dismissed it, being the total cynic and bitter, nasty piece of work that he is. He assumes everybody else operates on the same principles that he does. And so he called it disinformation, just rich, because he does peddle disinformation everywhere. And he assumed when we were giving him true information that we were lying to him. He does admit that it was because ISIS-K took credit for the attack. And so Putin does admit that it was Islamists. But Bill Galston, he says that they were acting at the behest of Ukraine and Britain and the United States, and that this is part of the West's war on Russia. I just am curious, you know, whether you see as much as I do this parallel where the forces of disinformation and authoritarianism are so alike. I mean, they will use any crisis or any atrocity or whatever to sow division and to enhance their personal power. We used to be able to say, boy, those Russians are really screwed up. But now you look at it and think, yeah, I see where they're getting their guidance from. What do you think?
I don't think this lifelong KGB agent needs a lot of instruction from anybody in the West.
He's giving the instruction.
He's giving the instruction.
Our authoritarians are learning from him.
Perhaps, although I think we'd be on safer ground to say that internal forces within the United States have proved adequate to this new lust for disinformation practices. Because, as a matter of fact, this may sound harsh, but I think there may be more internal forces for disinformation in democratic societies than there are in authoritarian societies where the default setting is that nobody believes a word that the government is saying. But, you know, however you trace the causal arrow, this is one more step down an incline at the end of which nobody believes what anybody says about anything, right? I'm sure if you did I'm sure if you did a secret poll of Russians, do they believe that Ukraine, the UK, and the US are behind this this Islamist catastrophe. I don't think you get a majority saying yes. And I don't think that Putin is really trying to persuade them otherwise. This is a classic diversionary move, you know, to try to put his external enemies on the defensive. And of course, to some extent, it's bound to work, because if you allow these farcical allegations to go unchallenged, well, then it may seem to some as though you're acknowledging them. So you're forced to respond. And at that point, you're playing Putin's game. So once again, like Trump, in this respect, his willingness to employ these tactics leaves the people on the other side of them with no good options. This is one element of hope. There may be some Putin admirers in Western societies who will have to say to themselves that he's jumped the shark here. That he's made claims that no one can possibly believe, and that he doesn't believe, obviously. And that maybe that will cast a retroactive light for them on the validity of some of Putin's other claims. I mean, that's possible. I'm not saying it will happen, but it could. So I'm not sure what else there is to say, except once a KGB man, always a KGB man.
So, Pete, it's, of course, very difficult to determine what average Russians really think about anything, because it's not a free society, and you can't trust polling, et cetera. But I'm not as confident as Bill Galston that if you took a poll that were an honest one, that you wouldn't find a majority of Russians siding with Putin here. You know, we all, maybe we don't all remember, but I'll remind us of what happened in, what was it, 1999 or 2000, when Putin was just coming to power, and there were a series of apartment bombings in Russia that were blamed on the Chechens. And then later it turned out that we had testimony from a Russian police officer that FSB officers had been seen delivering explosives to these buildings.
Right.
And the people who got this information out were assassinated one by one. And, you know, this could very well have been, I mean, we can't say for sure, it could well have been Putin's way of, again, you know, creating, in this case, really in the most sinister way possible, actually blowing up Russians in the apartment buildings to gin up hatred of the other and strengthen his hand politically.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I mean, it's impossible to tell, of course, because it's a totalitarian society. So we don't know how much the Russian people disregard what Putin says and how much they believe. I do think that amount of disinformation in a society like Russia has profound malformation effects in all sorts of ways, not just on information flow, but the moral malformation of people. You know, when I was thinking about this story, I mean, the thing that struck me about it is, the first is that Donald Trump, while he wasn't a KGB agent, has learned those tactics. I really can't find much of a distinction between what Putin does and what Trump does in terms of the kind of misinformation. The difference, of course, is that in this country, we have countervailing sources of information as well. But when you're talking about the people on the right, you know, Bill's thesis is an interesting one. Maybe there is a lot of discount factor that goes on because they've been under that society, some version of that society, for well over a century now. In this country, it is different. And what is striking to me, having had a lot of conversations with MAGA supporters and Trump supporters, is a lot of them believe it. A lot of them have adopted the conspiratorial mindset, and that's not going to end anytime soon. So this epistemological crisis that we're in is very, very difficult to know what to do about it, because the disorientation that it creates, the incapacity for persuasion, is something that we've not experienced in this country. Elements have always existed. I mean, people have challenged facts, certainly challenged narratives before, but the degree to which it's happening in this country is new. And I think that's part of why people aren't quite sure what to do about it, because the phenomenon is not one that we're familiar with.
And right as we're so unable to deal with this, in comes AI and deep fakes and the rest. So it's only going to get more challenging. Linda, there's an aspect of this that I'd be curious to hear you on, because Putin has been open now in this instance about the brutishness of the response. So the suspects in this bombing, they haven't been tried. We don't know if they're the real guys or not, or just four guys, whatever. Even if they are the real guys, they were beaten up. One of them had his ear sliced off and it was shoved in his mouth. The videos of these have been circulated throughout Russia. And I have a sense that because of the propaganda and the heated, stimulation of hatred that the Russian press has been engaged in now for 2 years because of the war on Ukraine, that it has sort of lowered the resistance of the Russian people to that kind of brutality. And I'm just curious about what you think of that. And do you see any parallels here with Trump saying, they should beat him up, they should shoot shoplifters, et cetera?
Right. Yeah, no, it is sort of horrifying. I mean, look, this attack was terrible. I think there are legitimate questions that have been raised by people like Garry Kasparov and Brett Stevens about, if it went exactly as described, because it took over an hour, apparently, after the attack, the perpetrators or accused perpetrators got away. So, this idea that it might be similar to the blowing up of the apartment buildings in Moscow back more than 20 years ago, and we have to be at least open to that possibility. But that's not the point you're making. The point you're making is how Putin responded and how he uses that basically to gin up his people and to increase his support. And it's kind of the bloodlust that it is so really immoral. I mean, think about the United States on September 11th, 2001. And in the aftermath, I mean, we saw those airplanes crashing into buildings. We lost thousands of people. We had, it was a catastrophic event. What did President George W. Bush do afterwards? Did he even, we soon learned that it was Islamist extremists that had done it. Did he try to whip the people into a frenzy to descend on mosques around the country and start beating up Muslims and holding them responsible? No. Now, a lot of people criticize him for talking about Islam as a religion of peace, and one could, make an argument against that. But what he did was to try to not have collective guilt, particularly of the people in the United States who were Muslim. That is so different than what Putin did. I mean, displaying these videos of ears being cut off and shoved into people's mouth, this is just obscene, and it is very dangerous. And what is most frightening about it is you can imagine all the Tucker Carlson fans out there just eating this stuff up. Right?
Yeah.
Donald Trump egging him on. Boy, there you go. Flag.
He's being strong.
Yeah, he's been a strong man. I wish, the way in which he admires Kim Jong-un, who starves his people, imprisons them, kills them, tortures them. He wants our people to respond more like the North Koreans do. Well, I mean, I think he would love to be able to do this if he could get away with it. It's just demoralizing our national conversation, literally. So I'm very upset by it. And I think we don't know right now the full story of that attack. We may find out more. It may be exactly as it was presented. It may have been these guys. They may have been simply, expressing their Islamist extremism, ISIS-K. But there also may be more to the story than we yet know.
Damon, any reaction from you?
Well, I guess there is a difference between, I think, the way a lot of us imagine kind of the totalitarian outlook on truth, which is as propaganda, that there's truth out there, but then there's what this totalitarian government gives as a counter-truth. And it tries to insist that the people in that regime believe that counter-truth instead of the real truth. Whereas I think what Putin often plays with, and what I think Trump often plays with in a way that is very, very dangerous, is actually slightly different. And to make that point, I actually want to quote a friend of the pod, Ann Applebaum, who's also a colleague of Pete's at The Atlantic. I actually wrote this down because I liked the quote so much when she said it on a Sam Harris podcast. She was talking about the downing of an airliner over Ukraine in 2014, and 300 people died in this crash on the plane. And the way Anne talks about how Putin handled it. This is a quote from her. "The Russian media didn't say we didn't do it. Instead it released literally dozens of different explanations. There was one explanation that the Ukrainians shot them down because they were trying to hit Putin's plane. There was another explanation that said a lot of dead bodies were put on the plane on purpose, and it was crashed on purpose to discredit Russia. Many of these explanations were absurd, but the proliferation was such that it created mass confusion around the event. Radio Free Europe did a very good series of interviews in Moscow just afterwards, and they asked people on the street, 'Why did that plane crash?' And overwhelmingly, people said things like, 'Oh, we'll have no idea, and we'll never know. It's impossible to find out. The truth can't be known.' The effect of Putin and Putin's press with this multiplication of explanations was that it obfuscated the very idea of truth. And that's very useful to a dictator. Putin doesn't want people to believe anything because, you know, maybe somebody will print how much money he really has. What Putin wants is for all these stories to be undermined. If you tell lots and lots of lies, then people don't know what to believe." And that is the threat. And as you mentioned, Mona, with AI and deep fakes, this is only going to get worse. And it is distressing. And I think liberal societies have barely begun to figure out what the hell to do about it.
Exactly. All right. With that, let's turn to our highlight or lowlight of the week. And we'll start with you, Linda, this week.
So those of us who live in the D.C., Maryland area were very focused this week on that horrific collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. In Baltimore, I, for one, someone who has crossed over that bridge hundreds of times in my life here. It happens to be on the way to my doctor's in Baltimore. So I'm very familiar with that. It was just such a shocking event. But what I want to focus on is really a series of articles about the workers who were killed. There were six men who were working on the bridge. They were fixing potholes. It was cold, in the middle of the night, 1:30 or so in the morning. And who were these workers? They were immigrants. At least one of them, family, has said that he was an undocumented worker. I suspect that more than one of the six were here and undocumented. And one of the things that strikes me about this is that if you look at the demographics of Baltimore, immigrants are not nearly as common in Baltimore as they are, say, in the District of Columbia, where we have huge numbers of immigrants, particularly from Central America. But these workers were there because they were doing dirty, dangerous jobs that other people don't want to do. And they are part of that essential workforce that we have in America that is made up of people who are not born here, but see the chance to do these dirty, dangerous jobs as their foothold in having a better life, not just for themselves, but more importantly, for their families. So I want to pay tribute to these men who gave their lives. I think we shouldn't forget, you know, when you got Trump out, you know, banging the drums for rounding up and throwing these people, kind of people, into detention camps in the desert and shipping them off without any due process at all if he becomes president. I think it's important to remember that these people are good people doing important work, and it's often work that Americans don't want to do.
Thank you. Bill Galston.
Well, my highlight for this week, and it is a highlight, is a woman by the name of Marilyn Lance. She is not a household word, but maybe she should be. She won a special election for a seat in the Alabama Senate by 25 percentage points, having lost by 7 percentage points in her previous run for exactly that same seat. What was the difference? The huge controversy over IVF prohibitions in the state of Alabama, and by extension, the very, very restrictive anti-abortion regime that Alabama has set up. To the best of my knowledge, every single election since Dobbs, where this issue was central, has gone extremely badly for whatever unfortunate Republican found him or herself on the other side of the argument. I don't know what kind of impact this is going to have in 2024, but I confidently predict that it's going to be measurably greater than zero. And if I were Joe Biden and found myself debating Donald Trump, I would beat him over the head with this issue, because Trump is all over the map. He doesn't know what he thinks, except that he doesn't want to get caught in the political undertow. And I think that he will probably reveal himself in the course of trying to evade discussion of this issue. This is not a small matter.
Thank you, Pete Wehner.
Yeah, my low light and highlight are in the same week. So I'll just speak here as a person of the Christian faith. This is the most sacred week for those of us who are Christians, Holy Week. And the low light comes on Friday, which Jürgen Moltmann, a theologian, called the crucifixion of God. That is when Jesus is on the cross and dies for our sake. The highlight gives way to Sunday and the resurrection. And that, for those of us who are believers in the Christian story, is when death gives way to life and justice is restored and all things are made new again. So it's a big low light and a big highlight in a compressed period of time.
Thank you for that, Damon Linker.
Well, hard to follow that one, but I'll do my best. Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced to 25 years in prison. Those who don't know his name, he was convicted of stealing $8 billion from customers of his FTX cryptocurrency exchange. And no, I don't really have strong enough feelings about this guy for this to be my highlight or lowlight of the week. However, I do have very strong feelings about Tucker Carlson. And so, in light of that, I would like to quote Tucker Carlson from November 10th, 2022. He had this to say, quote, "Biden's Justice Department seems not very interested in a man called Sam Bankman-Fried. Why is that? Well, because he was the Democratic Party's second biggest donor. No warrant has been issued. Why? Well, because he's a political ally." So there we see Tucker's excellent prediction about this individual's fate, showing that, yes, of course, the Democrats are at least as, if not more, cynical than Republicans, and therefore this guy will walk scot-free. They'll never give this guy a hard time. Well, he was wrong about that, too.
25 years wrong.
25 years. He could have been sentenced for 110, but I'd say 25 years is still a very long time. Go to jail when no one was killed.
Yes, exactly. Okay, thank you. I would like to draw attention to a piece that ran in the New York Times by David Brooks. Last week, we devoted a fair amount of time to discussing the war in Israel and Gaza and some of the things that we think Israel is doing wrong and right. David has a long piece. It's entitled, What Would You Have Israel Do to Defend Itself? Where he goes through the challenges, the particular challenges of this war, of trying to fight an enemy that has 300 miles of tunnels below ground, and that, as we all have said multiple times, has a tactic of specifically putting its civilians in harm's way, hides behind them. This isn't in David's piece, but I would just say parenthetically, you know, there's this reporting that, you know, I was listening to the BBC about the fact there's reporting on there's fighting at Al-Shifa Hospital. And the way the BBC presented it was, you know, for some reason, the Israelis are attacking a hospital again, those damn Israelis. Well, the fact is that, you know, Hamas has moved back into Shifa Hospital, which they had been in before. And that's why there's a gunfight, a huge fight going on in that hospital again. But anyway, David goes through some of the difficulties. He consults a lot of military experts. He talks about the challenges. He's, you know, it isn't uncritical of Israel. He does think they need to do a better job about, you know, humanitarian aid, or at least presenting the challenges. But he says this, and I think this is a quote, give you a flavor of some of the things he concludes. He says, Israel has done far more to protect civilians than the United States did in Afghanistan and Iraq. Spencer, this is one of the people he consulted, reports that Israel has warned civilians when and where it is about to begin operations and published an online map showing which areas to leave. It has sent out millions of pamphlets, texts, and recorded calls warning civilians of coming operations. It has conducted four-hour daily pauses to allow civilians to leave combat areas. It has dropped speakers that blast out instructions about when to leave and where to go. These measures have telegraphed where the IDF is going to move next and have prolonged the war. So it's important to keep this in mind, as opinion in the United States appears to be moving very sharply against Israel because of the daily photographs of Palestinian suffering. I think that's understandable. I do fault Israel for not doing a better job at public diplomacy. I think Netanyahu in particular is very truculent in his presentation. But David's piece really does lay out the facts on the ground and why, you know, many of the proposed solutions, including that Israel simply not invade Rafah and let things go the way they are, would be a catastrophe, because it would be a victory for Hamas if they were to do that. So it's a very, very tough situation, but this is one of the most clarifying pieces that I have seen on the war. So David Brooks, What Would You Have Israel Do to Defend Itself? With that, I want to thank our guest, Pete Wehner. Thank you so much for joining us. Also, all of the regulars and our producer, Jim Swift, our sound engineer, Jonathan Seary, and of course, our wonderful viewers and listeners. And Beg to Differ will return next week, as every week.